Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safe in traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State. My AccuWindow forecast says it's about 35 degrees, wind blowing outside, but at least the snow is melting. We're glad you're here. The solar wind tonight, it started out today pretty mild, but it's actually a blistering 728 kilometers per second right now, and we're sitting right in the middle of a strong solar wind coming from a coronal hole facing Earth. The sun is blank today with no sunspots, but we are putting out an aurora watch for high latitudes tonight. So if you make your way outside tonight, make sure you check for the amazing Borealis. Cosmetics giant L'Oreal showed human skin growth in the laboratory from cells removed from donor skin left over after cosmetic surgery. Tests have shown it gives more accurate results than animal skin. The new skin has been cleared for use and will now be available to use in the cosmetic industry. Dr. Estelle Tin... Oh boy, this is French. I don't speak French. Anyway, her name is Estelle, who led the research, said it was very important because following regulation in 2009, the cosmetic industry will not be allowed to sell any cosmetics made with raw materials that have been tested on animals. So it was absolutely fundamental that we get this model, she said. People are amazed at what we've been able to do. They say, wow, you can grow human skin in a laboratory. That's fantastic. Well, it might be great for the cosmetic industry for testing, but it certainly shows promise for reconstructive surgery as well. We wish them well with that research. During solar minimum, the sun's magnetic field, like Earth's, resembles that of an iron bar magnet with great closed loops near the equator and open field lines near the poles. Scientists call such a field a dipole. The sun's dipolar field is about as strong as a refrigerator magnet, or about 50 Gauss. Earth's magnetic field is 100 times weaker. During the years around solar maximum, like during the years 2000 and 2001, spots pepper the face of the sun. Sunspots are places where intense magnetic loops, hundreds of times stronger than the ambient dipole field, poke through the photosphere. Well, sunspot magnetic fields overwhelm the underlying dipole. As a result, the sun's magnetic field near the surface of the star becomes tangled and complicated. The sun's magnetic field isn't confined to the immediate vicinity of our star. The solar wind carries it throughout the solar system. Out among the planets, we call the sun's magnetic field the Interplanetary Magnetic Field, or the IMF. Because the sun rotates once every 27 days, the IMF has a spiral shape. And this is called the Parker Spiral, after the scientist who first described it. Now, as the sun's magnetic field is carried out through the solar system, the sun is rotating. Its rotation wind winds up the magnetic field into a large rotating spiral. And this Parker Spiral is kind of interesting, because this week, it is causing quite a geomagnetic storm above our planet. Just thought you should know the details behind how that happens. Last week, we had on our program John Riley. He is the owner of Zero Point Research and the inventor of the Lifestream Generator. Very well listened to program live, and people have been listening to the archives all week. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that, make sure, because maybe you were tied up with something mundane like the Super Bowl, you need to go back to the archives and listen to that program, because he gave us some great information. This week, we have a special treat. Recently, we became acquainted with a most credible and diligent researcher into ancient Egypt. She is an engineer and an entrepreneur with a passion for understanding one of the most mysterious and obscure locations in ancient Egypt, Abydos. Many have visited this out-of-the-way temple of Seti, but not since Om Seti has anyone been able to put all the pieces together like tonight's guest. So please welcome with me Melissa Goldberg. How are you, Melissa?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, Abydos is one of the more difficult places for Westerners to reach. How did you become interested in ancient Egypt altogether?
That goes back to early childhood. As a young child, I began researching all ancient civilizations, but particularly Egypt. It wasn't until a few years ago that I was able to travel there for the first time. And At that point, I had never heard of Om Seti, and it was upon leaving the Seti Temple that I noticed a book that was written about her by Jonathan Cott and Hani Alzini, and I picked that up and realized what an amazing woman in life she was and had.
Well, you know, when you felt this connection, you know, how did you follow your desire for more knowledge? What led you or facilitated you to schedule that first trip to Egypt, and why is it you made your way to Abydos? That's really kind of off the tourist track, isn't it?
It is. There are some tours that go there. You have to join a special convoy that brings you in. I went with a group that William Henry was one of the presenters on, and we were able to spend, maybe 2 hours there. It wasn't nearly enough. I had already researched the temple before going and realized that there were some pretty amazing things about the temple, and there were so many differences in comparison to the rest of the temples in Egypt. And after that first visit, I realized that I had to go back again, and I came home, continued my research, and studying everything I could get my hands on concerning the temple, particularly Aum Seti's life, reading everything that I could find that she had written and co-written, and engaged in tracking down and communicating with Hani Alzini, and we have become great friends. He's a dear friend. And
now, how did you, when you contacted Hani, I guess you just researched his number and gave him a call over in Egypt. How did he receive you at first?
At first, it was very formal. When I realized that he and Catherine Deese had just released a book that they had published in 06, there was a website up for that, and it had his email. I had been trying to reach him and contact him and asking other friends that I had in Egypt to help me track him down. When the new book came out, I was able to get an email address for him and contacted him just at first basically asking some questions that I needed answered for the work I was doing. And it just led from there. We got to the point where we were emailing on a daily basis.
He was kind of excited to see that not only had someone picked up his book on Aum Seti, but was interested enough in it to read well past those pages and maybe in between the lines and say, hey, I had these thoughts. Did you have them too? I guess he kind of felt a kindred spirit in you.
Yes, yes. He understands it.
Hani is he's an engineer too, right? He's works for a sugar plant or something there in Nag Hammadi or near there.
Yes, he's retired now. He when Egypt declared independence, the National Sugar Company had been under French, British, and Egyptian. I believe it was Nasser that. During the Suez Canal and after that, shortly after that, nationalized the sugar company, and Hani became the director of the Egyptian National Sugar and Distillery Company.
Wow. So he was a pretty important fella in Egypt and a really, you know, not only well thought of, but also well financed, and he became interested in this area of Abydos. How early did he start working on recovering or uncovering Abydos?
I believe his first visit there was in 1946. At that time, clearing hadn't really begun. It had initially been cleared and excavated in the late 1800s, but in the late 1940s, it was still pretty much buried in sand and really in a state of disarray. And then in 1956, after he was already the director of the sugar company there in Nag Hammadi, which is fairly close to Abydos, he began visiting, which is when he met Aum Seti, and they became friends. And he continued to visit and watch basically the putting back together the pieces of the temple. Aum Seti put together thousands of fragments, pieced them back together. In restoring the temple, supervised with the re-roofing.
Now, I find it really interesting. I don't know all the details about how Aum Seti came to be or that, but I definitely want to cover that just a little bit later. But I want to try to maybe get this my arms around the chronology of this, because Abydos is a unique temple, isn't it? It has qualities about it and things inside of it that don't exist anywhere else in the world. What is it about Abydos that makes it unique?
Well, the first thing that sticks out is the design of the temple. It being in an L shape is very unusual. Most temples were in a rectangular shape. Seti's temple takes a turn to the left, heading south. In doing so, it's believed that he turned in the direction of the temple to avoid building over the Osirian, which is directly behind the western wall of the temple.
So there is a connection with this Osirian, right?
There is a connection. Mainstream academia will say that Seti was responsible for building the Osirian. It's often been called the cenotaph of Seti, but Absolutely, he was not responsible. That is far older. It was there before he began construction on his temple. There's many points that prove that.
Now, the Osirian, it really doesn't appear to be of Egyptian origin. So who do you think built it?
Well, that I'm not sure of, but I know that when you compare the architecture and the design, it's first of all built of granite, very large granite blocks, anywhere from 50 to 70 tons and on up. There are only two other locations in the world that resemble and have the same distinct cornerstone that the Osirian has. It's corner blocks that don't come together and meet joints. It's one single block that goes around the corner, and that the
Whoa.
Other ones can be found in the Valley Temple on the Giza Plateau, which has been attributed to Pharaoh Khafra, but then there is also the Gate of the Sun in Machu Picchu that has the same style of building.
No way. In Machu Picchu?
In Machu Picchu.
But they're gray granite blocks. You're saying the block is actually machined in a right angle for a corner?
Yes.
Wow. Well, where did this granite come from to make these stones at Abydos?
The granite came from the Aswan Quarry.
Now, how far away is the Aswan Quarry from Abydos?
About several hundred miles.
Several hundred miles?
Several hundred miles.
Now, you said that these blocks weigh 50 to 70 tons and some even bigger than that. How do you move a granite block several hundred miles across sand? I don't see how that could be done with that, even today's technology.
I don't either, and that's one of the mysteries of places like the Osirian. The mainstream view is that they were put on barges and floated down the Nile, and that there was a canal, the Nuez Canal, that communicated on up to the Seti Temple. Now, we know that that canal was used in bringing in the limestone blocks for the building of Seti's temple. But with the weight of the granite, and the size of the columns and the roofing, there's just no way. Could not have been done. Not by boat.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Some of these blocks are 80 feet long, and they probably weigh more than 70 tons. We're probably talking close to 100 tons. These are single blocks, right? They're not like bricks put together. This is a single piece of granite.
Yeah, very large single blocks.
Are they machined, or are they rough cut, or are they smooth?
They're very smooth. It's very, very clean. Anyone that has seen photos or been to the Valley Temple, they're on the Giza Plateau. The architecture and style and design of the blocks are almost identical. Very smooth, clean cuts.
I know one of the pieces of block, it kind of sits outside the grounds of the Sphinx. It looks like a curved piece of cornice stone, but it's one solid block of granite, and it looks just like crown molding, except it's 3 feet thick. And I for one, I mean, I've seen them machine granite today. I know how it's done, but I don't know how that could be machined. Not today. I sure don't know how they machined it back then. But you're saying this predated anything Egyptian, right?
Yes, that's my belief.
Wow. So I guess the next question is, because a lot of people wonder about this when they walk out behind the Temple of Abydos, as if their heads aren't already, you know, being scratched, they walk out back and say, holy moly, what the heck is that? What do you think it was used for?
Well, I know that at some point in time, originally I'm not sure what the uses may have been, but I know that in some point in time it became used as a place of initiation. Strabo wrote about it in 23 BC in his chronicles, Geographies of Egypt. And there's also some information in one of the papyruses, the Leyden Papyrus, that describes an initiation process, describes it taking place in Abydos. And the description that it gives of entering into Geb, which is the earth, Geb receiving you, the description is almost identical to the Osirian. And it's also identical to the description that Strabo gave. At the time that he was there and visited it, the thing was covered with a mound of dirt and surrounded by a ring of trees. It was very dark inside. There was a central island. There's several small cells, maybe 8 by 8, that were believed to be different rooms that you would go through for these initiation processes of being in the dark.
Why would that be part of initiation? What were the initiates trying to overcome by going through this process?
Well, they would go through a symbolic death and rebirth, and they were trying to achieve enlightenment. In the Leyden Papyrus, when it speaks about the Osirian, it speaks of Heresus going in through the long passageway. There's a very long passageway that heads to the north.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down. It was decorated by Seti's grandson, Seti Marin Ptah, with the Book of Gates and the Book of Caverns. During this descent down into the earth, they come in, and it's described that they go through different ritual processes, have a ritual cleansing, and then they go to sleep on this central island. It's a central platform that's within the main hall of the Osirian. It also describes that they are sleeping near the resting place of Osiris, where he sleeps and is surrounded by water. So the thought is that the tomb of Osiris may be hidden somewhere within the Osirian, or at least his head. The stories change and vary throughout the different periods of Egypt, but the main two that stay there is that the tomb of Osiris is there, or that at least his head is buried there, his essence and his wisdom.
Well, let's think about two things here. First of all, why do you think the original builders of the Osirian built it there? What's special about that piece of geography?
Well, the area of Abydos goes back very far into the archaic times, pre-dynastic. It's one of the oldest places of continual pilgrimage on the planet. There was an area there, and it's still there. There's a cleft in the rocks out in the western desert that you can see from Seti's temple. It's called Peg of the Gap. It's a gap between the limestone cliffs there, and that was believed to be the gateway to Amenti, which is heaven. There is a stairway, Osiris's stairway, a stairway to heaven, was also there near that Peg of the Gap area. They've uncovered tombs and stelas erected during that time all the way back to the First Dynasty. Very near the Osirian itself, Frankfurt, Professor Frankfurt did excavations and was able to find pottery and artifacts dating to pre-dynastic times right there at the same level as the Osirian. So that's another evidence of its age being far older than Seti's time, which was the 19th dynasty.
So it was a place of pilgrimage, a place where ancient pockets of civilization put together caravans to come to this place and then return from, but it also probably had a local society that lived around it, cared for it, cared for the pilgrims that came in, and were part of the surroundings of the Osirian. Now this gap, which lies off, you can sort of see it as you look off toward the west. It looks like a pass would look like through the mountains. Have you ever been up there, or has anyone ever gone up there to actually see if if there was evidence of this Amenti being there?
I have not been up there. There have been many excavations in that area right there at Pega, right at the gap. There is an old temple that was built for Osiris. There's also a First Dynasty tomb very near the gap. At this point, the average tourist cannot get out there. There's I've tried. I'm hoping that the next time I go, I'll be able to go out. But it's about a 30-minute Jeep ride out there.
I didn't hear of any Jeeps in that area for rent. You mentioned at the beginning that one had to join a convoy to get out there. What describe for our listeners, because I know most of them have probably never been to Egypt, what is a convoy and why are they necessary?
Well, the convoy is all the tourist buses line up and they're escorted by the military, and there's several checkpoints that you go and check in along the way and pick up a new group of escorts. And you leave from Luxor in the morning, and basically they shut down all the side roads and roads through the various villages that you're going to travel through and get everybody out there as quickly as possible. It is quite a ride. It's a 3-hour drive by bus, by convoy, from Luxor.
So are you going, like, through military checkpoints? Is there, like, a timing or a manifest of people? I guess the government just has to make sure nobody's wandering unescorted through their country uninvited.
Yeah, and that's part of it. It's very safe in Egypt, and part of that is because of the precautions that are taken, so that they know where the tourists are at all times. It is possible to travel to Abydos on your own. You can catch a train from Luxor to El Bahia, and from there catch a cab about 10 miles further to get into the area of Abydos. You have to register with the police, and you have to register when you get to the train station, and then register again when you get to Abydos. It's not an easy thing to do, but it can be done.
So if it's a 30-minute Jeep ride from Abydos up to this gap, you might have to walk it. How far do you think it would be to walk?
Well, that would be if you could get past the guards. They've got towers surrounding the Seti Temple, and you'd have to get past them, and I'm sure they would discourage it very strongly. The whole entire area between the Seti Temple and Pega the Gap is a huge necropolis area that is still has ongoing excavations and digs going on out there. They strongly discourage tourists from going out. You would have to go out with a local guide or as part of an archaeological team.
Well, it's clear that there are at least two ancient civilizations that have occupied this place. How, do you think that the Seti knew that this was here and he hunted it out or sent his engineers out to find it, so that he knew exactly where to build his temple?
I don't think that he knew that the Osirian was there. He was told in a dream by Osiris to build his temple at that spot. It definitely was not an area where the rest of the temples were built. They were all built closer out there towards Pega the Gap. He was directed in a dream to build on that location. I don't think it was till after he began the construction of the temple that he realized the Osirian was there. He knew it was a very sacred spot. He knew that it was one of the most important places in the area. But at the time of his building, I believe that the Osirian was probably covered over with sand once again.
Mm.
He did restorations in the ceiling in in the eastern transverse hall, which is sometimes called the sarcophagus hall, only because the ceiling in there resembles the underside of a sarcophagus lid.
Mm-hmm.
It's another evidence of Seti not being the builder of the Osirian, is the fact that he did restorations and put that down on there, that he was restoring that area. Every pharaoh that built a monument absolutely put their calling tag on it and stated that they had built it. That's not to be found anywhere in the Osirian.
You mentioned that they might have floated the blocks on the Nile, and that there was maybe anciently a canal there that was used to move the limestone blocks. Was there another source of water there that, from which the community drew, or around which this facility was built?
Yes, there is an ancient aquifer, a natural spring, there underneath the area of Seti's temple. It comes out in the northeast corner cell of the Osirian. Strabo wrote about it. It's been known as the Well of Roarings because of a gurgling and bubbling sound that comes up out of it. The water in the Osirian has a reputation for having curative properties. Many people have been healed. Om Seti was able to never need the use of her glasses again after splashing water in her eyes. She had a very bad case of appendicitis and was able to overcome that by getting in the water. She used the water. The local women would come to her when their children were ill, and she would use that water to heal them. It helped with infertility problems. She cured a child of epilepsy by giving that water and reducing fever. So there's a lot of mystery surrounding the water, and particularly the Well of Roarings. There's also many stories of a light being seen coming from that northeast cell. The light source coming up from deep down where the entrance, where the water comes in from the aquifer.
You mean like at night, when all the lights are out and there's no candles or torches or anything, that they can actually see a glow coming up through the water?
Yes, there's a glow that comes up through the water. The cell is roofed, so there's just a small door there. So even during the day, if you went in, it'd be pretty dark in there. Hani Alzini had some of the water tested to determine if he could figure out what was causing the light source. And he was a chemist. And I don't recall right now what it was that he found in the water, but there was a property that he felt would cause a fluorescence in the water. But the old legends go back that there was an ever-burning lamp within the Osirian, a lamp that was not an oil lamp. It was a lamp that generated its own power.
Like a chemical light.
Yeah, and I would think almost like an arc lamp. That's my thoughts on it.
Wow. So an arc lamp would imply that there was some kind of electrical current flow.
Yeah. There's many stories, not just at that area there in Abydos, of these lamps being in use. There's depictions there in Dendera at the Temple of Hathor that kind of resemble, a light. It's always been a big debate on how they were able to sculpt the walls, put the reliefs and registers on. Those were only done after the temple was completed and roofed. So without any light, it's amazing how they were able to put such beautiful reliefs on the walls. And you find the tombs that are fully decorated and colored, and no deposits of soot, no evidence of oil lamps in there.
Well, that's interesting that not only did they have a source of light, But the amazing thing is, as you go up and down the Nile and you look at all of these temples, and trust me, if you take a month and you go through these temples in Egypt, you're going to be templed out in a very short amount of time. But one of the things you're going to notice is that these reliefs are impeccable. The proportions of the body, the repeatability of the hieroglyphs, the condition of the stone that was removed, leaving the relief, is always the same. It's just as smooth as if it was rubbed out with a stone. And, you know, in our society, we don't have two people that have the same handwriting. Mm-hmm. In that society, you have literally thousands of years of artwork that matches. Now, how do you explain that?
Well, the scribes were, at a very young age, trained to be very precise. It was very important that the glyphs be absolutely precise. It was believed that the glyphs had a power and a spirit of their own, and particularly the reliefs. Anytime you see reliefs of gods or goddesses or deified kings, these had the ability for the ka, the spirit of those gods, to enter into them and animate.
So it was like the person coming up on these things and viewing these things would receive a message or receive an inspiration, or something inside of them would change or alter, and they would come away inspired or even enlightened just by seeing these replicas.
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the two-dimensional images that you're seeing on the walls will actually come off as a three-dimensional image. The hieroglyphs have a power within them that is almost, you know, they're a language of the mind, a language of the consciousness, and they will speak to the person who sits and meditates on them. And you look at the basic translations, and they're right on a surface level, but there's so much more detail beneath that can come out. And the oldest of the texts, which were called Sufs, date back to the pyramid text, which were found in the Memphis necropolis area, in the Saqqara area. And even then, you know, 5th dynasty, they were very old at that time. There's a huge compilation of pyramid texts there. And at that time, they knew, you know, there were 700 glyphs at that time. And throughout the ages, there were glyphs that were added during the Greco-Roman period. The Greeks were fascinated by the hieroglyphs. They understood that there was a great deal of magic in them. And
well, it does seem amazing that 700 glyphs is equivalent to a 700-letter alphabet. We have a 26-letter alphabet. We barely have, 150,000 words in our whole language. It sounds like with that many, not only would you have a very complex but a very precise language that would speak perfect messages.
Yeah, with the glyphs, they, you know, there are those that have a phonetic value assigned to them. A lot of them will have multiple meanings, and depending on what other glyphs are with them, will determine what is being said. There's also definitives that are used that will give you an idea, the determinatives that will give you an idea of what the subject is. Determinative would be used just as a picture image to confirm what is being spoken about. They had.
Well, one of the things that I notice, having raised four kids, is as they get into school and they start learning how to read, they already know how to talk, and they already know what an apple is and a dog is and an airplane and water and all of that stuff. They could speak, you know, volumes. But when it comes to associating the picture that's in their mind of a puppy or a glass of Kool-Aid with the printed words, sometimes there's a disconnect, and it takes a while for a human to grasp that. I mean, we just don't learn to read at age six and go on from there. We're continually refining our reading skills as we go throughout life. As beings, we're made to think and communicate in pictures. We're made to convey thoughts as images, as icons. Mm-hmm. And it seems amazing that this is really the only society, the only earth center where real, precise, pictorial language was used. And it doesn't seem as though it developed. It was just there. It was like handed to them, like it was a complete technology. Is that what you see as well?
Absolutely, yeah. When you look at the pyramid text, particularly those found under the Pyramid of Unas in Saqqara, those are so extensive, and it's such a huge amount of text. It shows that it was in use for a very long time, and it's a very extensive language. You know, and that being the earliest text, extensive like that, that can be found, you have to wonder, you know, where did it come from? You know, the stories say that Jehute gave hieroglyphs to man, gave them to Osiris, and Osiris presented them to man.
Wow, Jehute would be also known to many listeners as Thoth, right?
Yes, Hermes.
Interesting. Well, we have about 15, 18 minutes left in this hour. Let's see if we can finish off our analysis of the Osirian. If there was unique properties to the aquifer, and if there were maybe electrochemical properties to the water or to the flow of the water or the exchange of the ions, do you think the Osirian possibly had the properties of a power station anciently?
Yes, I believe so. There's a huge amount of destruction that was done to it, and you know the question is, well, how did this happen? How did the architraves and the roofing slabs get blown off of this thing? They're laying down in the bottom of the Osirian under the water. They certainly didn't get quarried away or taken away by the locals, as some of the temples have happened to them. These were just far too huge, and there's evidence of either a massive earthquake or this place being, you know, blown apart.
Hmm. Well, do you think the original builders were done with it, or do you think they had enemies, or you think they just didn't want to leave something behind? Where do you think they went?
Well, I believe that they had been gone for quite a while by the time Seti got there, considering the condition it was in when he found it. The northern entrance, which extends well beyond the Tremnos Wall. Tremnos Wall was a wall that was put around the sacred precincts of the temple area. And Seti's Tremnos Wall was erected before he realized that northern passage was there leading to the Osirian. Otherwise, he would have extended his wall out further to include the northern passage. There's also evidence of him doing restoration there at the beginning of the Northern Passage that he shored up with just mud brick.
His engineers seemed to go through some effort to try. Once it was discovered that the Osirian was down there, maybe they went down to make a foundation or something, and they said, hey, there's something down here, and then probably got instructed to build around it. Do you think that somehow they tied the two structures together after some consternation?
I believe so. I believe that there's a lot more to the Osirian than what we're able to see. I believe that it goes further down, and that there's also there is evidence that Seti's temple is built on top of an older temple. There's a series of there's two rooms, upper and lower, two-story, called the blind rooms in the northwest corner of the Seti temple that don't seem to have anything to do with his temple. There are huge columns in there that just do not fit with Seti's style of architecture, and it seems that the columns, the diameter of them, are far too large for the height of the rooms, and that they extend down to an older temple. Now, in Egypt, it was very, very common practice for new temples to be built right on top of older temples, and you can find two and three levels of temples. they'd get covered over by sands and someone else would come along and build on top. It was more about the site itself that was important.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. Do you think that maybe SETI thought that the original builders of the Osirian might return someday and share some of their power with him or enlighten him with further technology?
I think that he may have thought of himself as a guardian or protector of technologies that may have still been there, buried deep under the earth at that time.
Well, what was the focus of the temple at Abydos? It seems like every temple, every pharaoh kind of has his thing that he's going to concentrate on, whether it's the Book of the Dead or different things. What was the focus of the temple at Abydos?
It had many different functions. First of all, being the site where the mystery plays would take place, the New Year's festivals that celebrated the life and resurrection, life and death and resurrection of Osiris, and the battle between Horus and Set when Horus was avenging the death of his father. So you had these plays that would go on, and there would be a certain route, processional pathway for those. But then there was also the daily cult ritual, which took place. And normally, most temples would be dedicated to the particular god of that area. There would be a triad, husband and wife, and then a child, and then Thebes and Memphis, Heliopolis. They had these triads. In Seti's temple, he dedicated it not only to Osiris, Isis, and Horus, but also to the gods of the other main capitals. They had the Memphis triad was there, and the Theban. There was also a completely separate cult, which was the cult for the royal cult for the ritual, ritual for the royal ancestors, which was a completely separate function of the temple, and that was for remembering and honoring and keeping alive the kings of the past.
So there were rituals to help the people remember or know a being known as Osiris, right? Well, who was Osiris?
Well, there are so many stories surrounding Osiris. If you go back to the oldest story and legend of Osiris, he was a man that walked on this earth and achieved enlightenment, ascended into a light body. He was, in the oldest stories, murdered by his jealous brother Set and just left by the banks of the Nile, where Isis, with the help of Anubis, was able to find him, resurrect him temporarily to conceive their child Horus. And then the story says that he is buried there in the area of Abydos. Throughout the ages and different kingdoms, the story evolved to Set cutting him into pieces. It's anywhere from there's 14 pieces to 42 pieces to 72 pieces, and as the story evolved, it would be that each nome or precinct, each capital area of Egypt, would each have a piece of Osiris buried there, just as the church today will have, you know, a finger of a certain saint or the blood of this saint. It seems that even in ancient Egypt, Each nome or area liked to lay claim to having a part of Osiris with them.
That's interesting. That crosses over into a lot of different cultures, not the least of which is the Catholic culture, but also Gnostic cultures. Even the Freemasons believed that the possession of the skull and femur bones of a certain woman would provide power and success to them. So, in your opinion, did Osiris really exist, or is he a magical figure, like the cable channels say?
I believe that he existed as a man, and then was able to ascend and achieve that light body. The ancient gods and goddesses are representations of certain principles of the one god, Amun, the hidden, and they became, just as in the Muslim faith, they have the 99 names of God, and also in the ancient Egyptian beliefs, quite a few. Particularly as time went on, so the gods incorporated each other and took over each other's jobs, and names were blended together, and jobs were blended together.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about that body of light. When you say that Osiris was able to put on a light body, what is it that's meant by that?
The Egyptians believe that they had several different funerary beliefs. One would be going to the land of Amenti. You would, and that would be heaven. You would have to pass through judgment, where Osiris acted as the judge, and your heart, which was your consciousness, would have to be weighed against the feather of Maat, and you couldn't tip the scale. If you were judged worthy, you were able to go to Amenti or heaven. And some of the Middle Kingdom and New Kingdom text, when you get to the coffin text, where the nobles and the average person were having access to this afterlife, there were gates that you would have to pass. You would have to travel through the underworld and pass through certain gates and have the right words of power and know the names of the guardians of the gates in order to pass safely, to go through these gates and then be arise again, just as the sun rose again.
Well, that sounds pretty familiar. Now, you mentioned the nobles and the kings. So at the temple, how did they allow the average person to see this process of putting on a light body, of getting these words of power, of knowing where these gates were and what sentinels needed to be passed and how to make themselves, quote, worthy to go to Amenti? How did the average person get access to this?
The average person was never given access to that. The temple was reserved for only the highest priest, and when some of the most important rituals were being informed, it was just the high priest acting in place of the pharaoh, or it would be the pharaoh himself performing the rituals. The information was never to be seen by the eyes of the average person.
Wow.
It was kept very, very secretive. And there were points in Egypt's history that the priests were not even allowing the pharaohs to have access to the full extent of the knowledge during different times when they were under foreign rule.
Maybe the pharaohs weren't behaving themselves. But was there a public festival or any kind of like a play or anything that they would put on to that a common person might come in contact with to sort of keep him abreast that the leaders of the country are working their way to heaven and we should follow them because of that?
Yeah, there would be the Jubilee festivals or the Hepsed festivals that would take place to instill and rejuvenate the power of the king and show his worthiness to keep the country in balance and unified and protected. These would take place, and all the people would be there to see this. It was the pharaoh's job to keep the country in balance for
the
protection.
Now, what was the Jubilee? In Abydos, what would be the Jubilee festival?
Well, there are many different versions of it. There would be a festival of the king having to chase a bull around the temple, lassoing the bull. This was done at many sites. And there were times, if the pharaoh was up there in age, that he could have a stand-in. These were just basic festivals that were done not every year, but sometimes it would be every 15 years as the pharaoh increased in age. There weren't many of them that ruled for such long periods of time. Seti son Ramses II had a very long reign. And there's depictions on the temple walls of his festivals, and there were times when he had a stand-in when he towards the end of his reign.
Ah. So did they ever explain to the average person or the surrounding community about this death and resurrection of Osiris by Isis?
The stories were there. The stories were there. It was often believed that this was this resurrection was only reserved for the pharaoh.
Right.
In the beginning, the average commoner felt that there was nothing after death other than repeating births, other than coming back and reincarnating. It wasn't until the later New Kingdom that the word started spreading among the nobles and non-royalty that they also had access to heaven and not returning back to this plane.
When now Seti the First, right? Seti the First is the one that built Abydos.
Mm-hmm.
And that's which dynasty? Is that the
19th?
The 19th. And what year would this be by our calendar?
By our calendar, Seti ruled, let's see, when did he rule? It would have been 1,300 years, about 1,300 years ago.
1,300 years ago.
Or to it.
Okay, that would make it about
He ruled in 1300 to 12. He has ruled for about 15 years, and I believe it started in 1306 BC.
Oh, BC, okay.
BC.
So
3,300 years ago.
Within 12 or 1,300 years, that area of Abydos, was it in poor repair, or was it... I guess I'm getting to around the time of Christ. The time of Jesus, would it have been in good repair, or would it have been just buried under sand?
Well, it's very possible that the stories of Jesus visiting Egypt. It's very possible that Jesus may have been in that temple at that time. That temple would have been operating. As the Romans took rule, they came and there was a lot of destruction, just purposeful destruction of the temple. Among the early Christians, there was an early Christian settlement there, and among the Romans filled the temple with bulls that had been used for sacrifice and burned them. Lit them on fire and burned them. So there's a lot of damage that the Romans did and the Christians did to the walls of the temple, where they defaced the walls and scratched off the images. And that was their fear of the power that the image had. And they felt that by defacing the faces and hands of the gods and the images on the wall, that they took away their power. And they took away their power to come back to the temple and visit the temple. The temple was thought of as the house of the gods or the residence of the gods.
That's interesting. Well, we are we're at the top of our first hour, and I want to thank the audience for their patience in laying down this academic part, because the next 2 hours we're going to open up your mind to some things about the ancient world and its involvement and foundation with our present society that you might not be aware of, and we're glad that we have Melissa with us tonight. We're going to take a short break, about 4 or 5 minutes, give everybody a chance to change to the next hour. This is a 3-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3, let us know. We'll get a hold of your affiliate and fix that. We'll be back right after these messages, so don't go away. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back.
Life extends life.
To X Squared Radio.
Life expands consciousness.
We're coming to you live.
The spice is vital to space travel.
From Eastern Washington State, where it's cold and crisp and clear tonight. We've got a great program for you tonight. Remember, this is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, let us know. We'll get a hold of your affiliate, and we'll fix that for you. Have a couple of items here. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, went to the publisher today. Now, they're pretty fast about getting that through the printing process. It's published by Ming Source Printers, so it will be available on our website in about 3 weeks, and shortly thereafter, it'll be listed on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, blah, 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 all the online booksellers. We're going to have some specials for you to purchase all three books. We are in the process of beginning the recording of the audiobook for Volume 3. So those of you that are not avid readers, don't worry about it. We read it for you. You can put it on your shelf and know all the knowledge that's inside of it without ever turning a page. Also, a little bit of news about the expedition to the inner Earth. Our producer has made a little bit of progress. We've made a little bit of progress. It looks like things are off top dead center with that. As you know, this is the largest scientific expedition ever done by a civilian group, so it does have its logistical problems and its challenges. We're overcoming those one by one, and hope to bring you the voyage of the century, not too distant future. We are coming to you through the BBS Radio Network and also through Steel Eye Media, courtesy of Kevin Smith. And this hour, we want to go ahead and open up our phone line. So, if you have a pencil, you can write this down. If you don't, you can always go to the website at x2-radio.com or bbsradio.com and pick up these numbers. Write them down, put them on your refrigerator. So as you're walking around with your wireless telephone in hand, you can call in and ask a question. We're talking about ancient Egypt on a level that is not discussed on the cable channels, and I think you'll enjoy it. Anywhere in the U.S., toll-free, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, 877-489-6350. That's 877-489-6350. And if you've got unlimited long distance on the weekends, which most people do nowadays, anywhere on planet, off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530. A lot of phone lines that are available for you. If you don't use a phone, if you're using the voice over internet like Skype, you can reach us simply by putting in BBS Radio. Or if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. We take all comers, and we're about to turn on the AOL Instant Messenger. So if you want to reach us through AOL, just do a search for my handle, which is Vision Officer. If you don't know how to spell, just go to x2-radio.com. It's right there on the cover. Our guest tonight is Melissa Goldberg. She is an engineer. She is a very detailed researcher about ancient Egypt. And we're going to have a lot more coming from her in just a moment. I want to let you know NASA is looking for a catchy new name for a science satellite. Currently it's called GLAST. That's for Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. Yes, that's boring. So the satellite will search for gamma rays from decaying dark matter particles and investigate black holes and the violent events that produce gamma ray bursts. It is expected to launch in mid-2008. So NASA says we hope someone will come up with a name that is catchy, easy to say, and will help make the satellite and its mission a topic of dinner table and classroom discussion, says Alan Stern, Associate Administrator for Science at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Acronyms are allowed, as are scientists' names, but only if the scientist is no longer alive, and no other NASA mission is named after them. So, if you want to participate in this, and anyone can do it, it doesn't matter what age you are, you need to go to glast.sonoma.edu and then /GLAST name, all lowercase. That will be posted on our website at x2-radio.com. If you should happen to be struck with an amazingly catchy name for a satellite, forget about naming a star. Name a satellite. That's someplace you could really hang a piece of history. Of course, you know there are 68 active NASA missions now in space. The ones with the catchy names are the ones people remember, just to give you some idea. Melissa Goldberg, we are glad to have you back. my first question for this hour. Many of the things that are recorded on the walls at Abydos sound very familiar to those with Luke chapter 2. If we're familiar with that story about the virgin birth and the life and death and resurrection of a Savior, it's kind of interesting that here, 1300 B.C., recorded on the walls of Abydos, is a very similar story. It doesn't seem that it first came about in Bethlehem some 1,300 years later. Just in our last hour, those of you that didn't get the first hour, we mentioned that it's quite possible when Jesus, Joseph, and Mary fled Herod shortly after he lived in Egypt for at least 12 years, that they made their way to Abydos. So let's talk a little bit about the similarity between these stories and see if we can explore some truth here. Are you there, Melissa?
Yes.
Okay. What are your thoughts on this subject?
Well, you know, there are those that have speculated that it's possible that Jesus may have made that trip with his family. As I said earlier, the trip to Abydos was something that every Egyptian, commoner to noble to kings, strived to do at least once in their life. Many of the pharaohs had tombs built there. Even if they weren't buried in that tomb, they may have a tomb up near Cairo, in the Saqqara area, in the Memphis area, and then have a second tomb or cenotaph erected there in Abydos. It was very important that everybody take a journey there at least once, and you know, have some sort of a monument or stela erected stating that they had made that journey. So
well,
it's very possible.
If the temple was operational at the time that this exile family was there, and they made a pilgrimage to Abydos the way many did from around various kingdoms, what do you think they would have seen when they came to Abydos? Were there special days?
Yes, the average person going there would join in with the celebration of the New Year and watch the mystery plays, which were based on the life of Osiris, his life and death and subsequent resurrection. So everyone would be familiar with that story. The end of the parade and procession would have ended up with a reenactment of the battle between Horus and Set, Horus being the son of Osiris, avenging his father's death. And an interesting thing there in the Seti temple are depictions, and it's always been a great debate over what they are, but there are the scenes there on the ceiling that depict what looks like a submarine, a helicopter, a UFO, modern warfare equipment. And one of the stories of this ancient battle between Horus and Set is recorded in Edfu at the Temple of Horus, which this temple was built at the, you know, the time when the Romans were there, the Ptolemies. Ptolemy III, I think, began construction on that temple. But at that time, in the archives of the temple, the priests put on the walls that they were concerned that the ancient knowledge and some of the ancient text was being destroyed and lost by the country being, you know, dominated by foreign rule. So they wanted to make sure that it wasn't lost, and there are several areas at the temple of Edfu that they put these stories, the creation stories, and one of the stories they put on the walls is the story of this ancient battle between Horus and Set. And between in this battle, it talks about the followers of Horus were in a fleet of ships, and likewise, Set's followers were in their ships, and the battle took place on the Nile. And during this heated battle, at some point, Set and his followers were able to turn themselves into hippopotamuses. that is often depicted as a hippopotamus in some of the reliefs. They were able to change form, go down underwater, and attack from beneath, kind of like you would think a submarine would do.
Wow.
And the story goes that Horus couldn't stand by watching this take place, so he transformed his fleet, or the ship that he was on, into something similar to a solar disk and rose up into the sky. And from that point, he entered into his sun bark or sunship and was able to get an upper hand. And it says that he rained down fire upon Set's men, and that the fire caused a great noise and such a terrific heat that the ground itself was melted, and all of Set's, all the enemies were consumed. So when you look at this story that's clearly depicted, and it states that this story is being written to preserve it, and that it's far more ancient than the temple itself that it was written on, it's just, you know, an amazing story, especially when you look at the images that are carved in Seti's temple that depict what absolutely looks like a helicopter and a submarine and a,
It is kind of interesting when you, it's like you walk in the front door and you could walk around the whole building all you want, and it's very difficult to find, but it's up in the ceiling, like one of the support beams or something that holds one of the stones to the ceiling.
Among the architraves.
There's no distortion about it. I mean, a close-up, any camera with a zoom can get a picture of these. And in some texts, I've heard them called vimanas. They're flying machines, and they have various abilities, but there is no doubt whatsoever that one looks like a Black Hawk helicopter. It's just amazing. I mean, nothing has fallen off, but there's no distortion. It is the profile of a Black Hawk helicopter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you were to ask any Egyptologist or any of the guides that are there, you know, about that particular area of the temple, they will say that, you know, this was, it's, you know, it just looks that way, and it's Ramses covering up artwork that the scribes had done during Seti's time. And there's many areas in the temple where Ramses recorded his own scenes and put himself there in place of Seti, because Ramses finished the temple. Seti was not able to finish the temple before his death, and Ramses did finish the temple, but Ramses finished the outer courts. The inner temple, the most sacred part of the temple, was built and constructed first, and that was done by Seti.
Huh. That's very interesting. I'm trying to think back the book of Ezekiel, when the book of Ezekiel was believed to be written, that maybe it was around 1200 BC when the book of Ezekiel was written. That's kind of interesting that not only in print, but also in, not hieroglyph, an actual pictogram, profiles of these vehicles. We're not talking about hieroglyphic writing. We're talking about a real relief depiction of these craft. Just like you would see on, you know, any science fiction movie or on any military channel special. It's pretty interesting. Now, you say that Horus went up in his solar disk. One of the things that you see when you go around Egypt, everywhere, above every door header, is this sun disk, this flying disk. And you know, there's another legend, which was allegedly translated by Zacharias Sitchin, of a society that came here known as the Anunnaki, and they allegedly traveled in these flying discs. And there, well, of course, you know the movie that's about to come out called One Anunnaki, put out by John Gress and Florida Effects. We should be seeing that movie come out this year. It's going to be fantastic. There's no doubt about it.
Wow.
There's lots of ancient evidence from many different sources that some kind of advanced warfare went on in the skies above this planet.
Yeah, with the Sumerians, it was the sky chariots. With Ezekiel, it was the wheel within wheels, wheels within wheels. To me, that also is reminiscent of, propellers of a helicopter.
Sure.
It's pretty amazing. If you look closely, there's so much evidence, within all the temples of technology that's been lost. And, of course, it's always open to interpretation. But when you try to consider what they were able to accomplish and some of the greatest things were done earliest on, and from that point it seems they de-evolved. It was almost as if, as time went on, they lost the knowledge for making some of these amazing structures.
Well, that's easily understood. You know, even in our society, we brilliant ideas, which are summarily absconded or taken almost free of charge under our system by those companies. And then the individual who actually thought of it might withhold a little bit of maybe how to actually make it work. And then maybe have a falling out with that company or die or realize that they're not going to get anything out of it, so they don't give anymore. And then the technology is lost. I mean, it's happened in the automotive industry. It's happened in the aviation industry. It's most definitely occurred in electrical engineering and chemical engineering. Amazing things, single things, like neon. At one time in the 20s, it was blue neon was very common. Now, you don't see it. Why? Because nobody knows how to do it. It was lost. Just not preserved very well under our system.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was some kind of great cataclysm now, which it could be, a disease or could be a cosmic event, if the engineers that really know how to do stuff were to perish, I can tell you, right, people who drive cars don't know how to build cars. It wouldn't be long before we actually lost the technology.
Absolutely.
So you give a couple of millennia or several hundred years, and given the fact that this technology only exists in one or two communities held close to the vest by one or two pharaohs, and it doesn't take much to convince me anyway that this technology once existed to manipulate large stones, to quarry them and move them unbelievable distances, raise them and put them into place with pins and all kinds of delicate balances. And then they didn't tell anybody how they did it. I think it would be cool. So, interesting thing, getting back to the beginning of our hours. So if Jesus and his family visited Abydos in his youth, and then he allegedly traveled to the East for 18 years for further study, do you think it's possible that he knew this legend? And I'm not saying he patterned his life and mission after this whatever passion play that he saw at Abydos when he was a youth, but it's clear that the history of it was well known by the common people.
Yes, and it, that story of Osiris, Isis, and Horus goes way, back to, the Old Kingdom. So it was a very, very old legend at the time when Seti built his temple.
Really?
Yeah. And these pilgrimages were being made, pre-dynastic. First dynasty pharaohs were building temples there and in that area. So it really goes quite a ways back.
Well, that's interesting. So well, let's just kind of pick it apart a little bit more. Not that I'm trying to tear anything down. I'm just trying to open people's minds and get them to think about things a little bit. Where does the word Bethlehem, what does it actually mean?
Is it Beth is house of or place of?
House of, oh,
that
I don't
I'm
know.
Not sure of.
House of bread?
Bread.
House of bread. Okay. So is there a city in Egypt that has a similar translation, house of bread?
Yeah, but there are also temples that were dedicated to the manufacture of a bread, which was a white conical bread that was, it's often depicted on the walls of temples. It's believed that it could be white powder gold, ormus. There
really?
Was a temple in Sinai that was excavated by Flinders Petrie. He was also extremely interested in Seti's temple, and he did a great deal of work there at the Seti temple, as well as other areas of Egypt, but I think his two passions where he spent the most time were there in the Abydos area and also out there in the Sinai. Now, his work was never published on the temple in the Sinai, but they were out there. They found evidence of not a bakery. There were implements for metalworking, metallurgy, found. And they also found, when they removed some paving stones, a huge amount of a white powder substance. He was unsure of what it was. The story was, you know, could it be potash or ashes from the burning of, you know, sugar cane or wheat? Or so there was a lot of speculations. But he was not allowed to publish his findings. And to my knowledge, that temple, that area, is not something that's open to tourists. It is out in the Sinai, in the eastern desert area.
Wow. Sounds like a little bit of ancient cover-up going on there, maybe modern cover-up. So what's the significance of white powder gold? What is that?
Well, if it can be related to this conical bread, white bread, that was fed to the pharaohs and offered, you know, by the gods and to the gods, the belief was that this bread was the food of life. It was a bread of eternity. It caused, you know, everlasting life. There's stories that this gave the ability to toggle between realms, to come back and forth from Amenti to the earth. You often see this conical bread depicted at the base of false doors, and the false doors are symbolic of the doors or the portals to Amenti. You see them within tombs. Also in Seti's chapel, you see them at the western end of all six chapels. In Osiris' chapel, the end of the chapel opens up into the Osiris Hall, but in the other six chapels within there, you see the false doors, and there's been so much damage to them, there's only a few of them that actually depict it. But you would see this conical bread on a reed mat at the base of the false doors, kind of as evidence of, you know, with this you are able to pass through the portal.
That's interesting. So, and I know a little bit of the research going way back, actually into the time of the Nephilim, that this pure food, or the ability to purify food with highly refined metals, was related to long life. I mean, extremely long life, like tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be that these societies, these cultures, tried to duplicate that more or less holy food to try to duplicate that kind of long life. But we don't really see pharaohs living extremely long lives, do we?
No, you don't. I believe that they, you know, the stories were there, they knew the legends and the stories, and they depicted it symbolically on the walls in the hopes that by putting it on the walls, it was there for eternity, and that, you know, when they died and they were at the end of their life on this earth, that they would also be given the ability to. So they reenacted all of this on the walls of not only their temples and their tombs in hopes to be able to achieve what the gods had achieved.
Well, again, you said, and I tend to agree with this, that there's great power in depicting this on the walls. And mind you, this is on the walls of the inside of the temple, not the outside of the temple. So the common people didn't get to see this. This was,
yes, not at all.
This was part of rigorous, disciplined instruction, but it was done in very small groups by those who had been trained generation after generation and carefully prepared, right?
Mm-hmm, yes. And for the most part, the priesthood was a hereditary entitlement. It was kept very secretive. Many instances where the high priest were, the sons of the sitting pharaoh, they wouldn't be in line for the throne, but they would be a high priest. So the pharaoh would have knowledge of the training that the son had received.
Well, I know, going back and doing my genealogy, that the tribe of Ham, which is the origin of the Egyptian people, decided not to partake of the priesthood. So the priesthood that was handed down through Jacob, Israel, to the 12 sons, Ham did not partake of that. So they stood their own way. Maybe they had, you know, greater knowledge or some knowledge, or maybe enough knowledge where they thought they didn't need the priesthood of the Jews. But here's the interesting thing. We're talking about white powdered gold, special food, special treatment of food, special training and rituals and icons. These are all just devices to accomplish a goal, which had really little to do with mortal life. It had more to do with an afterlife. It had more to do with eternal life, with accomplishing that resurrection, or even better, a state of ascension where one could literally toggle between times and between worlds. Did SETI create such a device and depict it on the walls of his temple?
I don't know that he created such a device. He may have found such a device in the during the construction of his temple, or he may have found written evidence of it. There is depiction in the archives of the SETI temple where there are some chests on the walls, and there's a series of three chests in particular. The first chest, and these walls are very badly damaged. They were never inscribed in relief. They were just painted, so the paint is very badly faded, and it's very difficult to read and to see. But Aum SETI recorded what she could while she was there, and of course there's been far more damage and fading of the paint since then. But in three of the chests, there's a depiction that it states that the first chest contained a great gateway or a portal, and she stated that, based on the description of what was in this chest, she felt that it was impossible for this to actually be in there, that it would have been far too large. And the second chest states that there was a part of, or a component of, the device that was in the first chest. And the third chest states that it's an instruction manual of some kind. So, you know, that's interesting to speculate, you know, on what that could have been. What was SETI trying to portray on the walls? Like I said, the walls have been, you know, very damaged.
But one of the devices, or at least one of the depictions that's on the walls in Abydos, it also exists one other place in a small, I guess you could call it a snapshot. I think it's Edfu where this is depicted. There's really only two places. And William Henry calls this the Osiris device. And he's really the author of this, and I really want to give acknowledgement to that because he's done a tremendous amount of work. And if you do have a chance, make sure that you listen to William Henry's interview, or if you get a chance to go see him somewhere, if he's speaking in one of your towns or close by, make the trip. Go to it. It's well worth it. But he talks about this Osiris device. Now, he's not necessarily claiming that it was a physical device, something like you might see on Stargate Atlantis, you know, that originates in Abydos, Egypt. But the correlation is undeniable that when engineers look at this thing, we don't see a boat with a carriage in the middle. What we see really clearly is an Einstein-Rosen bridge that appears to be very meticulously, artistically placed on the wall, twice, on two sides of one room. And it's pretty clear that with the use of the power plant of the Osirian, that maybe Osiris had something going there, and SETI thought he had an envision, or I guess I'm going to ask you, what do you think SETI was trying to put on the wall describing the resurrection of Osiris? What was he doing there?
Well, that I hope to find out in the future. My last trip over, I wasn't able to get into that area. I think I'll have to go through the proper channels and get permission to go in and photograph the walls using different lighting techniques. I'm hoping that I can cause some of that paint to show up a little bit better so I can see the rest of the story that's there. I'm not sure if what's depicted in the chest is the same, is talking about the same device as the Osiris device. It's definitely talking about a portal, a great gateway or doorway, and it may be that. Now, when you refer to the Osiris device, are you referring to the standard, the Shuti pillar, or the Osiris's bark, the boat?
I'm talking about Osiris's boat, the one with the blue stones depicted in what looks like a giant metal umbrella or electrical static collector. Mm-hmm. And it looks even like animals are being used on the side as motors to turn turntables to generate this static charge. Now, if you've ever had a chance to go to the Boston Museum of Science, or if you ever get a chance, please spend the $8 and go see the Tesla show, because they have the largest Van de Graaff generators in the world. Now, they're old. They're turn of the century, 1900 turn of the century Van de Graaff generators, but they generate several million volts. And they really produce lightning bolts 10 or 12 feet long. They pop so loud it hurts your ears. But it is amazing to watch this electrical show inside the Boston Museum of Science. And when I look at the Osiris device depicted on the walls, I see very similar characteristics to a Van de Graaff generator.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had thought, just based on the description that SETI gives in the various writings that she did, and it's also in the most recent book written by Hani Alzini and Catherine Dees, SETI's Egypt, the description, in my mind, I kind of first visualized like an ark, the Ark of the Covenant.
Do you think the Egyptians had it?
I'm sorry, I didn't... What?
Do you think the Egyptians had the Ark of the Covenant, or do you think they fashioned one?
I think there was more than one, yeah,
sure.
And absolutely that it originated in Egypt.
Do you think SETI had the ability to toggle between worlds?
You know, if he did, he certainly didn't leave any evidence of it. I would think that if he did have that ability, that we would know because he would. We wouldn't have his mummy in the Cairo Museum. But I think that he feared the knowledge and the technology and respected it. I think he was absolutely aware of it. You know, there was a book in the temple treasury that he was very concerned about it not getting into the hands of, you know, into the wrong hands. It was a book of magic. And I don't mean magic in the Western sense of the word, but the magic of Egypt was Heka, and it was a science. There was a science to it. It was very precise. And the book had belonged to Ahmes I, who was the first ruler, first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. How SETI got it, I'm not quite sure, but he had it, and he had it sealed away in the temple treasury. And he was very concerned that it not ever get into the wrong hands.
Has the temple treasury ever been found?
No, it hasn't. SETI tells a story of her accidentally stumbling in or falling into it during her work there and her life at the SETI temple. She, her office was in the Hall of Barks or the Hall of Boats, and there was a case where she had a bad case of the flu, so she was feverish and not feeling well, and she decided to go home for the rest of the day. And instead of going all the way through the temple, she decided she would go up the stairs from the Hall of Boats and walk across the roof and come down on the western side of the temple where there was scaffolding. They were shoring up the wall and replacing some roofing slabs at that time. So at some point between her journey from leaving the Hall of Boats and getting up onto the roof, she tripped and fell, hit her shoulder, heard a loud grating sound, and found herself tumbling down a steep slope, and heard the grating sound again as if something behind her was closing, and found herself in darkness. And after a while, she realized that she was in a large room and started feeling her way along there, and she realized right away that she was in the temple treasury. She could feel the different objects that were in there, and these would have been all the objects that were used in the daily rituals, the cult rituals, which were basically the toiletries of the gods, taking care of the gods. There would be a statue in each chapel of the god that the chapel was dedicated to, and each day they would be attended to. They would be ritually cleansed and cloth and clothing changed and jewelry changed, libation vessels, the whole thing. All of that, all of those supplies would be held in the temple treasury. So she found herself in there. There was also some of the equipment that were for the mystery plays, the yearly mystery plays, the statues, the large statues of the gods. There was a large statue of Osiris that was used during the mystery plays. Most of the time, all of the participants in the parade were, the parts were played by priests and priestesses. The part of Osiris was never played. It was a wooden statue that was used in place of him. So she was able to, you know, see these various things, feel them, and finally ended up not exactly sure how she ended up. She wasn't sure at first how she ended up outside in the sunlight, but she came up out of there and ran into someone who was looking for the antiquities director that was there, and so there was witnesses, the Guffiers or the watchmen, saw that she was covered in cobwebs and very dirty, and asked her what had happened, and of course she at first wasn't sure if she, you know, was delusional, if she, you know, had imagined it, but she didn't have her keys, and when she went back into the temple, she realized that there was no other way that she could have gotten outside, because her keys were still inside, and if she would have come down the scaffolding on the western back side of the temple, everyone back there would have witnessed her coming down. She tried many times to find her way back in, and apparently was never able to find her way back in. She did come out of there with a piece of cloth. At first she attempted to pick up a large golden...
She came out with evidence.
She did come out with evidence. She came out with a piece of cloth. It was like 3-foot by 5-foot piece of cloth that would have been used to drape over the statues of the gods during the daily rituals. And she gave this to Hani Elzini, and he had it sent off to a lab and dated, and it did date back to the during the time of the reign of Seti. After Aum Seti's death, though, she had the cloth and the paperwork from the laboratory, and by the time Hani was able to get down there after her death, that was missing, along with quite a few other things of hers were missing from her home. That particular thing, I don't think, was taken by anybody. I think that someday if somebody finds their way back inside the treasury, they just might find that piece of cloth and that paper from the lab. I think she may have found her way back in. I think that she may have left it as evidence to let, you know, everyone know that she had found her way back in.
We have we've talked a lot about Aum Seti tonight, and I know that many of our listeners have no idea who this woman was with this apparently Egyptian-sounding name. Can we just give maybe a 10-minute biography of Aum Seti, who she was, where she came from, how she came to be in Abydos?
Her name was Dorothy Eddy. She was born in 1904. She was from England. As a small child, she was about 3 years old. She had a bad fall down the stairs. The doctor came and pronounced her dead. And when he came back to see to the body, they found her sitting up in bed, wide awake and fine. And she claims that even at the age of 3, and she doesn't have a lot of memory of the fall and the accident, she does know that something changed at that point. That she remembers from that point realizing and knowing that something had changed within her. And she started having memories at the age of 4. Her parents took her to the British Museum, and they had to drag her out of there because she was running around kissing the feet of the statues. And was absolutely recognizing what she was seeing. When she was a little bit older, her father brought home a magazine that had photos of the Seti Temple, which was at that time in ruins and buried with quite a bit of sand. She immediately recognized it and was, you know, telling her parents that she wanted to go home. When they visited the museum, she, you know, stated these were her people. You know, she wanted to go home. This continued when she was about the age of 10. She started cutting school and going to the museum, where she met Sir Wallace Budge, who was then the director of the Egyptian department in the British Museum. And he kind of took her under his wing and instructed her, and they became quite good friends. She learned to read hieroglyphs. He started giving her pieces of pyramid text to take home and translate, and he was just amazed at her proficiency. And at one point, you know, he asked her, you know, why are you so fascinated with this? Why do you want to learn this? And she said, oh, it's not that I needed to learn it. I needed to remember it.
Oh.
So as she grew older, she met while working at a publication, a magazine that was working to help gain Egypt's independence from underneath British rule. She met an Egyptian man who was in England studying to be a teacher back in Egypt. So they became engaged, and that's how she ended up going over to Egypt.
So how old was she when she decided to go to Egypt? Did she just go to visit, or did she just pack her bags and catch the train one way?
She packed her bags and caught a boat. They were married in 1933, and she had a little boy within a year, and she insisted on naming him Seti.
Okay.
Which is how she got her name, because Om Seti means mother of Seti.
Oh, my
And in the folklore customs of Egypt, the name is very powerful, and you, if anybody has your name, it can, you know, it has holds a lot of power. So the women will go by mother of, and then whatever their firstborn child's name is.
How
so
about
it's,
that?
It's very common. You still find it among some of the outerlying villages. So that's how she came to be called Om Seti.
Well, now it's clear that it seems from this and her activities after her, we'll call it a near-death experience that she had, and her involvement with Sir Wallace Budge, that she was getting memories, as it were. So did it ever come to her that she was resurrected, or that she was the reincarnated person or a return person from that age and that time?
Yeah, it was a very long process. That she had an experience when she was 14, woke up out of a dead sleep, and basically saw Seti in his Sahu form, which is in his mummified form. So he was in his mummy wrappings. She just saw him standing above her bed. And then when she was about 16, she started having reoccurring dreams. She would dream that she was a young girl in a room with other young girls. She also had a reoccurring dream that she was this young girl, and there was a priest that was questioning her, interrogating her, and beating her. And she wasn't sure what it was that, you know, why she was being treated this way in these dreams, but she would just have these reoccurring dreams, and whatever it was he wanted to know, she never divulged it. So after she was married, she started having visitations just by a voice, a disembodied voice, that would wake her up and tell her to get up, and she would go to her desk, and this voice would tell her to write. And so it was kind of a form of automatic writing. Over the course of a year, she wrote pages and pages and pages of writing in the Demotic writing, which is kind of a shorthand, commoner language that was used during the time that the hieroglyphs were in use, but this was the common person's language that she wrote. She could read hieroglyphs, but she could not read this Demotic, and she had to, after a year's worth of transcribing all of this information, she had to then transliterate it and translate it out to read her own past life story. And it was at that point that when she started translating this out that she realized that you know, she had a past life. Her name was Bentreshet, or Bentreshi, which means harp of joy. She lived in a village near Abydos. Her father was a soldier in the military. Her mother was a vegetable seller. Her mother passed away when she was very young, and because her father was stationed elsewhere, he came home and he basically turned her over to the Osiris Temple. And turned her over as a vowed priestess, knowing that she would be fed and cared for. So her job as a vowed priestess was to learn the parts played, you know, by Isis and Nephthys in these mystery plays, these passion plays. So she would reenact, you know, in those roles. And it was during that time that, you know, as a young teenager, that she met Seti. When he had come, this was during the construction of the temple, he had come, he was sitting in a garden, and she had been out there in that garden, and he noticed her and called her over, and one thing led to another, and they fell in love, and as she puts it, they partook of the uncooked goose, which was an ancient term for prohibited relations, and because she was a vowed priestess, it was forbidden, even to a pharaoh.
Oh,
She had not been a vowed priestess and been vowed, you know, to remain a virgin, then there would have been no problem with their relationship. But it was considered, you know, the worst of sins, and they paid the price by waiting as long as they did. During conversations that she would have with Seti later on in life, he told her that he searched and searched and searched looking for her, and was told by the council that she was in a place of darkness and that she would not come back to Earth for a very long time. And
what happened to her?
As far as she knows, she was just in a place of nothingness, in a place of darkness, and didn't come back to Earth until this present life as on Seti.
So
she committed suicide in her past life. She was interrogated by the priest. Those were the reoccurring dreams she was having. They found she became pregnant by Seti. She was interrogated by the priest. She refused to say who the father was. She didn't want to bring disgrace to Seti, and she didn't think she could handle any more of the interrogations, and she ended up committing suicide.
Oh, my God.
So for that, she went into this place of darkness. And when she finally did come back to this earth, Seti realized that she was back in a body again, and you know, like as I said, starting from the age of 14, the first time she saw him that one time and didn't see him again until she was married.
Wow. Well, let's pick up right there when we come back after the top of the hour here. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes of commercials, and we'll be back, and we're going to pick up more of the story of Om Seti. This is absolutely fascinating. We'll be back after this. Our friend down at NRG Resources have introduced the new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, But you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad you're here.
The spice expands consciousness.
We're coming to you live.
The spice is vital to space travel.
From eastern Washington State, where it's clear and cold and crisp outside, we've got a great guest for you tonight. Melissa Goldberg is with us, and we're talking about the ancient legends of Egypt and those who researched it. Before we get started on our third and final hour, those of you that are not getting all 3 hours, please write us at info@x2-radio.com, will you? And let us know, and we'll get with your affiliate and get that fixed. We're coming to you through the BBS Radio Network and the Steel Eye Media Network with Kevin Smith. And also wanted to let you know the Ark of Millions of Years, which is subtitled Unlocking the Secret, went to the publisher today. So tomorrow it is going to begin the process of going to print. Should be about 3 weeks, and it will be available on our online store at x2-radio.com, or you can always go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and read about the book and find out where we're going to be appearing. If you want us to come by your city and give a presentation on the trilogy, mind you, this is almost 2,000 pages of the most comprehensive work ever done on the 2012 end times. We started with the creation of the earth and worked our way all the way to 2012, just hitting the points out of 44 of the ancient texts and bringing you as much original photography as we could. This book has 189 photographs in it. So if you like pictures, you're going to like the book. If you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. Buy the book anyway. We'll send you the audiobook. and you can listen to the book while you're driving and become an expert on the 2012 End Times stories. Also, wanted to let you know that the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition is continuing to move forward. Our producer in Hollywood is working with a major film funder. We'll let you know how that comes out. And we're also working with you, the general public, so that we don't have to give up too much of the film rights, and that way we can bring you almost 100%, if not 100% of what we learn while we're up there. It's important. The information's important, and getting there and getting back is important. Mind you, this is an expedition that civilians do not normally take. There's only one ship on the planet that can make this expedition, and that is the Yamal. It's a nuclear-powered Russian icebreaker, 450 feet long, 23,000 tons with 75,000 horsepower. No other ship on Earth can make this trip unless you want to go on a military submarine, and then you're not going to see much because last time I checked, they don't put windows in submarines. But we're going to bring you imagery from under the ice, as we're taking a world-class National Geographic accomplished under-ice diver with us. So we'll make sure that you get all the information that you can. Our guest tonight is Melissa Goldberg. She is an engineer, a researcher, and for many years has had a passion about the mysteries of Egypt, specifically she was drawn to the area of Abydos, and on the way out of Abydos, there is a little courtyard there where several vendors have things for sale, shawls and different kinds of jewelry, and also books. And one of those books was Om Seti's Egypt, written by Hani El Zaini and Catherine Dees. I highly recommend the book. But she picked up the book and became literally driven to get back to Abydos, and was fortunate to recently do that. In our last hour, if you didn't get it live, please go back and listen to the archive, because the revelation of Dorothy Eddy's life and how she became Om Seti, how she remembered who she was in ancient Egypt, is very powerful, and it's going to play a big part in this hour. In this hour, we're also going to talk about another mystery in Egypt that even fewer tourists make their way to. In our last hour, we learned that Dorothy Eddy became Om Seti, and she had a memory that she became overcome with despair because she was a priestess, saved and set aside for involvement, or from involvement with men, to serve in the Passion Play, but she fell in love with Seti. And because of doing that and the possibility of maybe bringing him down, she took her own life. And after a near-death experience at age 3, Dorothy Eddy begins having memories, and within 13 years or 14 years, she realizes who she is and sets about the rest of her life trying to get back to Egypt. And at age 52, she packs her bags and heads to Egypt. So let's pick it up from there, and then we're going to move on to another great mystery of Egypt. Melissa, are you there?
Yes.
All right, so what did Seti do after this young priestess takes her own life, and the priests lie to Seti about where she is? What did Seti do?
Well, he did it. The next time he paid a visit to the temple, he looked for her and couldn't find her, inquired as to her whereabouts, and he was told what had happened. At that point, he went into a deep state of despair and depression, and upon leaving, he never returned to the Seti temple again.
Wow.
At that point, it's thought that he was already co-regenting the throne with Ramses II. And at that point is when Ramses completed the outer courts and the rest of the temple.
Did Seti have a goal to find his love, to maybe use the technology that he'd depicted on the walls of his own temple to try one day to return to her?
Yes. When she asked him how it was that he was able to come to her, he told her that it was through the magic that he had learned as Pharaoh, and that he was able to return to her in his Ankh body, which could be related to like an astral body. It's called the glorious body. And through the use of her Sekhem, which is vital force or life energy, he was able to physically manifest. I don't think that everyone has the ability to offer up the use of their Sekhem. It had to be something that she willingly gave permission to do. She had to go and pray to Osiris, show her willingness to offer up her Sekhem and ask for permission to do so, so that Seti could physically manifest and be with her. They only had 4 years together, with Seti being in his physical form as far as them being physically intimate, and that was while she was still in Cairo. She spent about 23 years in Cairo before she ever made the trip down to Abydos. Working for some of the great Egyptologists, most of the time for no pay at all. She considered it training. And when she finally did go down to Abydos is when she was 52 years old. And at that time, Seti told her that from the point that she returned back to Abydos, she had to basically take up those vows again. So they could no longer be physically intimate. They had to, you know, he still visited in physical form, but all relations were ceased because upon returning, she was finishing out her life there in Abydos and keeping her vows. And she performed the rituals, she followed the ancient holidays and festivals and, you know, helped put that temple back together and activate it again and absolutely followed to a T the ancient religions. She had a book of days, which is like a calendar that she followed religiously to keep the old ways going.
So she returns to Egypt as though home was calling. And so when she arrives in Abydos, and now this is an out-of-the-way place. This is not a, you know, a big tourist commerce place even today. It's out of the way.
Right.
And I'm sure it was, you know, way back in when she was 52 years old and she arrived there. You know, was there a big fanfare, or did she just walk up to the temple and she knew where everything was? You know, what happened when she arrived?
Well, there was a lot of commotion. There weren't many Westerners that came to that area, particularly to live and work. When she arrived, she immediately went to the temple, took off her shoes, entered the temple, went in and offered up offerings to Isis and Osiris and said her prayers. And, of course, the watchmen and everyone there were just astounded. You know, who is this woman? You know, what is she doing? When she started in with work, her boss, the director of the Abydos area in the Temple of Seti, that was working on renovating, reconstructing, and shoring up the temple, tested her several times, you know, trying to figure out how she had the knowledge that she had of the temple. He would say, you know, in darkness, go into this room and go to this wall and find this. And then she would go right to it each time. She knew this temple as if she had been there her entire life.
Now, were there things published about this temple, or did she just, it seemed to those there that she had an intimate past knowledge of it.
There was certainly not enough published about the temple for her to have gained the knowledge that she had. As a matter of fact, she was able to point out things and show people where things were that no one would have had the ability to do, which is, I think, part of why she gained the respect of so many, Egyptologists, even though, you know, they're not willing to admit to some of the more, the reincarnation and all of that part of it. She was respected for her academic abilities, but as far as the rest of it, you know, there was always that, she's a little out there. But when she was able to point out things, for instance, she told him where the garden was, where the garden had originally been, and told him exactly where to dig and what type of tree they would find. And when they dug down, they found the roots of an ancient tree, and she'd, same thing, walked a few paces and said, dig here, and they dug down, and there it was. And she, you know, there's no way she could have known this. She took Hani al-Zaini at one time to an area not far from the temple and told him that in her past life as Bentreshi, that this is the village that she had lived in before her father turned her over to the temple.
Now, how long was it before she shared her story of reincarnation with Hani? How long had she been there before she did that?
Several years.
Really?
Several years into their friendship before she...
Oh.
And he had often wondered, you know, how does she know the things that she does? Where is this connection coming from?
Did he believe her at first?
No, he didn't. No. He did not believe her at first. He wanted to. He said that he feels that she was just one of the most honest people that he'd ever met. Very honest, very sincere, very open. Not one to be really into anything metaphysical. She actually, you know, did not share that part of her life with people until her final years. She just focused on her studies and on her work. And
did Hani ever come to accept that she might be the reincarnated priestess?
Absolutely, yes. He saw there's just way too much evidence. As I said, for instance, the village. And she took him and said, you know, there's a village right here, and this is where it's at. And it wasn't until, I think it was 1997, an archaeological dig was going on in that area, and sure enough, they uncovered a village. It dated back to that time frame of Seti's time. And this was completely buried in sand. I mean, there's incident after incident like that. Where she knew the location of temples and tombs and villages.
Well, this is phenomenal, just phenomenal. This, if you get a chance, you need to pick up the book Omsetis Egypt. That's OMMSETI, Omsetis Egypt, written by Hani al-Zaini and Catherine Dees. Really well written. I as I was going through the book, I was just amazed. Of course, I'm not completely surprised, because after all, Hani is a chemist, and we all know that all chemists are poets. So it doesn't take much of a leap to realize that a chemist can be a great writer. We are actually down to about our last 35 minutes or so. So I want to talk about another very amazing place in Egypt. Well off the beaten path, and definitely not on the itinerary of any tourist trip, is a place of the most amazing technology. It's the only place on Earth where this exists. It is so stunning to see, to lay your hands on, that I'm really surprised that it has not been more thoroughly researched. It is the most amazing piece of technology ever found in the deserts of Egypt. Saleh, and it's called Abu Ghraib. Abu means city of. It's located at the edge of a small town and at the doorstep of the deep western desert. It is absolutely fascinating with its power and evidence of high technology. Now, the grounds themselves are in poor repair, and face looks as though it was blown to bits by some ancient airborne attack. But intact is one of the most amazing pieces of stone on Earth. So let's talk a little bit about Abu Ghraib, Melissa. What did we find there?
Well, the alabaster platform that you're referring to, and I almost wonder, you know, what type of alabaster it is. It seems more, alabaster is also called the Egyptian crystal, but this platform doesn't remind me of the typical alabaster that you find. So it had to have come from a very distinct quarry, maybe a quarry that has been lost. It's pure white alabaster crystal, and to me it really has more of a crystalline nature than alabaster does. The site itself was the site of Nusra's sun temple, and what people call the pyramid there wasn't actually a pyramid. It was a truncated pyramid, a platform, but there was a obelisk on it originally. And
oh, really? It was an obelisk, and what was that made of?
I believe it would have been made of limestone, but there was also around the base of it was granite.
Now, is this the same granite like is around the Osirian?
Mm-hmm. The red granite, yeah, quarried from Aswan. And that's about 300 miles to the south.
That's a long way. Let's help our audience, because what is it?
I'm sorry, the phone was cutting out.
I'm sorry, what is alabaster?
Alabaster is it's a soft, easily workable, I would think, low-grade form of some sort of crystal. I haven't researched into exactly what it is. As far as the alabaster platform or the crystal platform that's there at Abu Ghraib, I haven't seen anything that closely relates to that at the different alabaster stores and factories. This is definitely something different. I'm not sure, like I said, where this alabaster was derived from, but there's also 9 alabaster basins there on the site, as well as about 7 limestone basins that are there, huge basins, maybe 6 to 8 feet in diameter.
Well, do you know of any of the unique properties that alabaster have? Why would they make such a structure out of this crystal?
Well, I'm not sure what they could have been using it for. I just recently, when looking at a top view of it, actually it was a view that you drew out with measurements. When I looked at it from a top view, I realized that within its design, there were hieroglyphs. The circle in the center is about 6 feet in diameter, and that represents Ra, which can be the light within the light, not necessarily the sun disk, not the sun, but just the hidden light, the light within the light. Surrounding this round disk are rectangular slabs, and on top of each rectangular slab, there is, we're back to that conical white loaf of bread. So as a hieroglyph, these signs, it's considered a hotep. The rectangular shape represents a reed mat, and the conical shape sitting on top of it represents that white bread, the conical white bread. So as a hieroglyph, it can be interpreted many different ways. The platform itself is lined up to the 4 cardinal directions, so you would think of it as an offering area. but also the same word can be translated as offering or peace, balance, harmony. Like I said, with hieroglyphs, they can have many different meanings, and based on what's with them and surrounding them, and if there's a determinative, you know, will help you clarify what the actual meaning is and what's trying to be depicted.
What other minerals are found at this site?
Well, there's mica. I think most of it's been picked up and carried away over time, but I found mica when I went. I have photographs of it. Huge amount of mica. The whole area surrounding the base of this truncated pyramid had pavers of limestone.
If you're taking calls, just acknowledge this. Nobody else. No, you can keep talking. The audience is not hearing me. Only the people on the line.
Oh, okay.
We do have a caller if you'd like to acknowledge it.
All right, we will in a second. Keep going,
Melissa. Sorry, I was cutting out a little bit.
We have a caller on the line, but we'll take the caller in about 60 seconds here. Just let us finish this point.
Okay. So, yeah, at this point, I'm just really trying to look into it and see what may have been going on there with the different materials that were there, what they could have been doing. I hadn't really had a real interest in it until I realized some of the things that this alabaster platform was saying. You know, it's a clue. It's a sign as to what may have been going on there.
Uh-huh. All right, caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Gail from Tennessee. How are you doing this evening?
Hi, Gail.
Really enjoying the show. Very intriguing. I want to ask you guys, are you familiar with, it was called Project Isis? The Russian KGB did a secret investigation over there in Egypt. And once they finally came to all of the findings, they pretty much closed up the tomb and it was not to ever be spoke about again. Now, what they found was a mummy in a sarcophagus that is an off-worlder. And this is all documented. So you can actually watch the movie. It's on the Internet. It's on vids, V-I-D-S, .myspace.com, and it would be under the secret KGB UFO abduction files. The film footage that they took of going into this tomb in there in the sarcophagus of the Great Pyramid, the film is authentic. It is extremely interesting what they found. And what their hypothesis is that the way the three pyramids are lined up there, the Great Pyramid and then the two beside it, are actually like a machine. It's an alien machine. And they started dating back because when you go into the king's chamber and the sarcophagus is there, they have it's like a chamber there. They call it the star chamber. And so it lines up, and they went back through star maps, and they took it all the way back to 10,500 B.C., and that's
right,
where they matched up, where the stars would actually come down in and go down that star chamber, and it would light up the sarcophagus, which in turn would cause some type of an electrical magnetism. And so it was like a machine that was used for what that, the only thing they can figure out, it was like a beacon that was sent out, and what it lines up with is that one of the stars in the three stars of the Orion Belt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this mummy, they had to bring the scientists in on this, the doctors and stuff. And all of the artifacts that they found around this project that they came out of the tomb with all dates back before 10,000 B.C. also. So this kind of was confirming where they were going with all of this. And when they did their analysis on the mummy, it shows certainly an off-worlder, and the mummy was not human, had large eyes, cavities, large cranium, small mouth, long neck.
Sounds like a Hathor.
Pardon?
Sounds like a Hathor.
Correct.
You know, it's kind of interesting as you go around Egypt and look for the various little statuettes that you can buy. Mm-hmm. You can't find one of a Hathor.
Mm-hmm.
You can find the carvings on the temples, but you can't find a statue of a Hathor.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting. Well, something that was noticeable. So,
this
Melissa,
is called Project Isis from the Russian KGB.
Do you remember where the tomb was found, where it was located?
Some of the Russian mafia smuggled it out for a fee. And the producer went over there and paid for this film, and then they had it authenticated, and it is the real deal.
Where was the tomb found?
It was the Great Pyramids. But this was back in the 40s or 50s.
But the Great Pyramid was not a tomb, and the sarcophagus, the people that call that a sarcophagus, is actually just a dream chamber, and it's been moved from its original location because of the resonance that happens inside that granite room. There is a low-pitch hum inside that room, and it does have a tendency to wipe room keys out.
There are many, many tombs on the Giza Plateau. And there are tombs now that you can go down in that even have granite sarcophaguses in that they've left down there because they have no way of getting them out, and these were cut into the bedrock, and they can't determine how they got the granite sarcophaguses down there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, if it was one of the tombs there that may have been very near the pyramid or down under the pyramid. There are subterranean chambers all under there.
This was in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid.
And it was in the 40s?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You can look at the film, you know it's old, but it's real. Yeah. And even when they first opened up...
Was there a mummy in the Great Pyramid?
Yes. Yes, and this mummy is not from this planet. Yeah.
Well, that had already been opened in the 40s. Actually, Amseti was working on the Giza Plateau with Professor Salim Hassan in the 40s, cataloging the digs and... all of the opening of the tombs there.
Well, when they closed that thing back up, they didn't put the mummy back in the sarcophagus. I don't know where it's at.
Now,
they kept it.
They may have been showing... There is a rumor that there is another hidden chamber that the public has not been given access to, that there is a second chamber within the king's pyramid, within Khufu's pyramid, the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been that's what they were looking into.
That might be it. Because they closed it up. They didn't. And there was something about... I'd have to go back and watch the film again because it's been a few days. But there was something about that this information and what they were able to verify of the mummy not being human and the machinery apparatus of what the pyramids actually were, and they trace it back 10,500 BC and all that. There's supposed to be some type of, what do they call it, a hall of knowledge that's somewhere under there, and everybody wanted to go in there that was part of this team now of the KGB, but they decided that it would be best to just leave things alone, and so they closed the area back up, and they left it, and it was never supposed to have been talked about again. So,
surprise!
I would suggest watching watch the movie, The Secret KGB UFO Abduction Files.
We'll see if we can find out about it.
Project
I'll
ISIS.
Find it fascinating.
Okay, bye.
All right. There's just so much out there. There's way more than you can go into in 3 hours. But let's talk a little bit more about Abu Ghraib. This is the one place that people just don't get. And this alabaster slab, besides being machined, I mean, tell us a little bit about the machine work on this slab.
Well, it's amazing. A lot of it has been eroded away or chipped away, but the cuts are precise, the sides of it are very smooth, and what fascinates me even more is some of the granite that's found around the area, that being even harder to core out holes, And yet there's a piece of granite laying just a few feet away from this alabaster platform that has just a perfectly smooth hole bored into it. And actually when you knock, when you can put your hand inside this hole and you can knock on it and around the outside edges of it, and it is absolutely hollow in there. It's almost as if the granite itself, the molecular structure had been changed in some way in order to have bored out this perfectly smooth round hole.
Now you're knocking on the granite with your hand?
Yes.
And it sounds hollow.
Yep, very hollow. Absolutely. Uh-huh. And if you get, you know, 6-7 inches away from the hole, you're then knocking on what granite feels like when you knock on it. The sound, you know, is normal, but when you put your hand inside the hole and just around the outside of the hole, it does not feel like or sound like granite.
Wow, that would have been nice if somebody hanging around would have got that on film. I mean, on video, but I know that doesn't exist. So why would a team of builders, thousands of years before Egyptians ever arrived along the Nile River, use hieroglyphs as part of their design? Why would they build this incredible piece of technology in that shape, in that location, with mica and alabaster and granite?
Yeah, and there was also, there had to have been water in the area. There's channels cut into the limestone paving that this alabaster platform sits on. Most of the paving stones have been pulled away, but there's still evidence of them being there. There's channels within the alabaster basins. You know, I'm not sure what was going on there. It's possible that it could have been one of the sites that was being used to manufacture the white powder gold. And, you know, that thought came to me, as I said, when I looked at the base, the platform itself. The main view is that this was a platform for offerings, but since most of the offerings were burnt offerings and this alabaster platform has zero evidence of anything ever being burned on it,
Well, it doesn't sound like it was built to the gods. It looked like it was built as some kind of technology. And the interesting thing, to get white powder gold from gold, we're talking monatomic gold now, not molecular gold, it does take high voltage. It does take an electrophoresis process that requires electricity. And one of the neat properties about alabaster and mica is that they build and hold tremendous static charge. So these alabaster basins with the sprockets machined in around them, and by the way, I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to provide a link at x2-radio.com. I'm going to post photographs of these alabaster basins so that you can see how amazing this technology is. So if you get a chance to listen to this archive, go back and click on the icon that we're going to put up there for the alabaster work in Egypt, and you tell us what you think about it. So you think that they were processing maybe the white gold there, and how far would you date this back?
Well, I would think that it dates back as far as the pharaoh whose name has been associated with it. I believe he was back to the 5th dynasty, Nisra, and he has a pyramid and tomb closer over to the Saqqara area. So this site here could be the same situation as Seti's, that there was a site previous to his putting his sun temple there. There is an inscription on a piece of granite there that states this is the place of the hidden god, or the way to the hidden god. It's broken off. It's part of that. Everything has been, looks like it's been blasted apart there. And I've searched around and tried to find the rest of the granite pillar and have been unable to find it to find out what the rest of the inscription would read. But, you know, a friend of mine, my friend and partner Kim, pointed out to me that crystal is used to maintain the balance, you know, in the electromagnetic energy between the North and the South poles. And, you know, I look at the way that this thing is positioned, as well as the pyramid, the sun temple itself being positioned, where there was an entrance on the south and an entrance on the north, and there are channels cut underneath it. So it's definitely a place that needs some more investigation. It's absolutely very old, and I think there's a lot of mysteries there that need to be worked out.
Well, now, if it dates back to the 5th dynasty, does this coincide with the Sea of Reeds?
That story would have been, yes, known at the time. These glyphs would have been used at the time, but they would go further back than the 5th dynasty. We know that pharaoh, Niusra, had set up, there's the remains of a causeway, there was a temple at the end of that. This site is attributed to him, but as I said, all of the sites were built on top of far more ancient sites, and he may have stumbled across one of these areas on Earth where the energy is where it needs to be within this grid line.
Well,
and
it's kind of interesting
was attempting
to see this kind of machine work, to see unbelievably large pieces of what is well known as electroactive kinds of stone and crystal being machined like this around areas that would be associated with mining of gold, processing of gold. We see very similar things in South America in areas that we know are very rich in gold. So why do you think that is? Do you think that these earth pharaohs were that infatuated with gold that they had to develop this high technology? Or do you think, like Gail, that maybe there's a little bit of off-world influence here?
Oh, I definitely see off-world influence here, particularly with the area of Abydos. And the name itself was one of the first things that caught my attention. Abydos is Abydon, it's Greek, but the ancient name of the Abydos area was the Abzu. And, you know, in the Sumerian text, in Zachariah Sitchin's work, in Ki, his area that was, you know, to the east, believed to be somewhere in Africa where they were mining gold or where they were working gold, was called the Abzu. And that
wow.
is the ancient name of Abydos.
So how far back do the Sumerian texts go that Zachariah Sitchin was working with?
Oh, gosh, what are they, like at least 6,000 years, some of the clay tablets, and they were probably copied from older texts than that.
This is going to be a really interesting year as one Anunnaki comes out. This is an independent film done by Florida Effects and Jaguar Films, which is owned by John Gress, who's a special effects artist for the film industry. This is an independent film that's going to raise the bar for other movies. There is a link to this film at x2-radio.com. Don't know that there's been much progress made on the website, but I do know that the film is done with post-production, and it's in music scoring right now, so it should be not much longer we'll see this film come out. Maybe it will it'll probably be the next generation of Stargate Atlantis. Hard to tell. I don't watch the program myself. Don't have time for it. Too much going on in my day job to do that. But it's clear that this is an important site, that it has extremely high technology. No place else on the planet does this exist. And interestingly enough, I think someone told me that while they were visiting Abu Ghraib, and this is in the winter time, it's hazy, it's cold, it's probably 40 degrees, which is kind of rare for that area. Out of the deep desert comes three Earth movers, one right behind the other. What do you think they're doing out there in the deep desert, Melissa?
Well, that entire area still has so much buried under it. It was a huge necropolis. There's no telling what they're doing. They wouldn't be doing any building out there in that area. The edge of town goes right up to it, and there's some groves, orchards and stuff there. But that area out there is still very untouched, very untouched.
Well, if you stand there and look to the south, it's nothing. I mean, as far out as you can see, nothing but sand. So you're saying that somewhere out there is buried the rest of the story. And it's
there's several temples missing, the sun temples. In the text, it talks about there being seven of them, I believe, and only two of them, no, six are mentioned in the text. But only two of them have been found, and that's there at Abu Sur and Abu Ghraib. But there were apparently six of them.
My goodness. Well, it's clear that Melissa has a four trip back to Egypt. We want you to get a hold of these more knowledgeable guides and maybe get your hands on a jeep or a horse or a camel or something and take a shovel, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. And I know you're not going to love because I know you're driven.
Yeah. Well, I've already made contact with somebody down in Abydos that has assured me that he can get me out there. I'll just have to see if, it actually happens. But he has assured me that we can take the jeep right out there. We'll have to take an officer with us, but... we will see.
Will the officer let you dig down in the sand or take a metal detector or, what will they let you do? I guess it depends on how many Egyptian pounds you take with you.
Yeah.
Well, one thing you have to do for sure is we're going to stay in touch, Melissa. Whatever you discover, we'll break it right here on X Squared Radio, because that's what we're about. We're all into the mysteries of the universe and the Earth, and we want it firsthand, as close as we can get it. And I can't tell you how great a pleasure it has been to have you with us the last 3 hours. It's just, I told you, it's amazing. We get on the phone, and 20 minutes later, 3 hours is gone. So I've had an absolute wonderful time. How about you?
I have had a wonderful time, too. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. And we'll make sure that you have a link to this, and we'll put an hour or two of this in the free listening area so that those of you that are interested in ancient Egypt can take your friends on a journey to places where tourists don't normally go. We try to go there as often as we can, and if we get a chance, we're going to go back, and we're going to bring you another piece and another piece until you have as close to the full story as we can get. Is that a promise?
Absolutely. Yes, it's an ongoing search.
Well, it's been absolutely our pleasure for you to involve us in your search and your discoveries, because there's more to be found here. And
absolutely,
it's going to be found by those who are driven the way you're driven. And you've got a memory like a steel trap, and the ability to read hieroglyphs, which are in and of themselves, remarkable pictograms. Now, as far as you know, the Egyptians are the only ones that use this style of hieroglyph, right?
Yeah, this style. It's very unique to the Egyptians. It's not the only ancient language that would be considered a holy glyph or a holy script. many of the ancient languages, those especially without vowels, were very powerful languages and absolutely had some hidden meaning within them, so much more than what is there on the surface level.
Right, right. And though some may call it magic, it is probably the science of communication, and the mere beholding of the image allows you to manifest whatever it was the writer had in mind for that to transmit, I think. Is that
yes.
your opinion as well?
Yes, yes. They absolutely have the ability to do that, yes.
What a powerful language that you could leave something behind in stone that would manifest an image and maybe even manifest the physical thing itself for that person who knows how to work those words of power.
Yes.
Great stuff. Great stuff. All right, well, we're out of time, and I will let you get back to your family and prepare for your week as I will mine.
Okay,
so thank you
thank
very
you.
Much for coming on X Squared Radio, Melissa.
Thank you. It was good talking to you.
Same here. All right, my friends, that is it for February 10th issue of X Squared Radio. We appreciate you being with us. Without you, we would not exist. We appreciate the team at BBS Radio for getting us through another great evening of X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers.